Heaps better. Why don't you come out with me tomorrow morning? I'll make sure you're okay. Sabine felt like weeping.
I really don't want to. Oh, God, I can't believe I'm stuck here. My life is just a bloody mess.
Tomorrow morning, just you and me. Look, it's better you ride out with me for the first time than her, isn't it? She looked up at him. He grinned. You know she'll eat you for breakfast. Most fearless seat in the whole of Southern Ireland, that woman. Still rode to hounds until the Duke went lame.
I'll break my neck, and then you'll all be sorry.
I certainly will. I can't carry a body all the way back with only one arm.
But the following morning, she managed to put Tom off again. This time, however, she had a valid excuse.
Now, I've got to go out for most of the day, and Mrs. H is going to be very busy, so I'd like you to take care of your grandfather.
Her grandmother had got dressed in her town clothes. At least, Sabine assumed they were her town clothes. It was the first time she had seen her in anything but old tweedy trousers and Wellington boots. She was wearing a dark blue woolen skirt of uncertain but certainly aged origin, a dark green cardigan over a round-neck jumper, and her ever-present quilted green jacket over the top. She had placed a string of pearls around her neck and had brushed her hair back, so that it sat still, in the way old people's hair always seemed to, in waves, rather than its usual electric fizz. Sabine fought back an urge to ask her if she was going out on the Raz. Somehow she knew her grandmother wouldn't find it funny.
"Where are you going?" she said incuriously.
"Enniscorthy, to see a trainer about selling him one of our yearlings."
Sabine sighed in ill-disguised boredom, the information already filtering past her unrecorded.
"Now, your grandfather will want his lunch at 1 p.m. on the dot. He's asleep in his chair upstairs, so make sure you wake him a good hour beforehand, because he will probably want to smarten himself up. Mrs. H. will prepare his lunch and leave it in the little kitchen next to the dining room, and one for you, so that he doesn't eat by himself. But you'll have to lay the table, because she'll be busy this morning, taking the windfalls round to the neighbours. Don't bother Tom in the stables, they've got a lot on, and don't let the dogs upstairs. Bertie got into your grandfather's room again yesterday and ate his hairbrush."
"Can't see how it can be of any great loss," thought Sabine. "He's only got about 2 hairs left to brush."
"I'll be back after lunch. Have you got everything?"
"Lunch at 1. Don't be late. Don't bother Mrs. H. Don't bother Tom. Don't let the dogs upstairs."
Her grandmother stared at her for a minute with her curiously blank gaze, so that Sabine couldn't tell if she was noting her tone of insurrection or whether, like herself, with horse stuff, it simply filtered past. Then she pulled her headscarf over her head, tied it firmly under her chin, and with a brief, adoring word of farewell to Bella, who had been standing anxiously at her feet, walked briskly out of the front door. Sabine stood in the hallway for a few minutes, until the slam of the door had reverberated into silence, then gazed around her, wondering what to do. She seemed to spend vast swathes of her day here, wondering what to do. All the elements that had effortlessly filled her days at home, MTV, the internet, hanging on the telephone with her mates, just mooching around the Keir Hardie estate, seeing who was around, what was happening, had been withdrawn, leaving her with this vast, vacuous space to fill. There was only so much time she could spend organizing her room. Besides, the blue shag pile made her feel physically sick. And if you didn't like horses, what the hell was there? She didn't want to go out to the yard, because she knew Tom would just start going on at her about riding that stupid pony. She couldn't watch television, because daytime television was sad, and last time she had tried surreptitiously to turn it on in the afternoon, her eardrums had been virtually blasted.
"It's so your grandfather can hear the news," shouted Mrs. H., who hurried upstairs to see what the noise was. "You'd best leave it alone."
Every night at 9 p.m, wherever she was in the house, Sabine could hear the thunderous roar of the news theme tune. Her grandfather would sit, peering at the screen as if he still had trouble hearing, while those around him read their newspapers, politely pretending they weren't being deafened.
Still, she thought, walking slowly upstairs, followed by Bella. Her grandmother's absence conferred something of a sense of release.
She hadn't realized how anxious the older woman's presence made her until its absence revealed this hitherto unknown feeling of calm.
A half day of freedom. A half day of boredom. She didn't know which was worse. Sabine spent the best part of an hour lying on her bed, earphones on loud, reading a 1970s potboiler that Mrs. H. had brought her. Mrs. H. had evidently decided she understood what young girls needed. Romance and more cake. And the way Sabine felt, Mrs. H. had got it just about right. It wasn't exactly literature. There was, however, lots of panting in it. The women were divided into sluts, who panted with ill-conceived lust over distracted male heroes who were just trying to get on with saving the world, or virgins, who panted with restrained longing as the same heroes skilfully seduced them. Only the men actually did anything. The women either got killed off, the sluts, or hitched to the men, the virgins. And despite all the panting, there was relatively little real sex. Sabine had flicked through first to see. Perhaps this was what being in a Catholic country was all about. Lots of panting and not much of anything really going on.
Like you, Bella, she said, stroking the dog on her bed.
Panting made her think of Dean Baxter. She'd almost kissed him once. It was not like he would have been her first kiss. She'd snogged loads of boys, and had done more than snog with some, although less than most of the girls she knew. She had known he was flirting with her, and they had been sitting on the wall of the estate after dark, and he had been really close and joking with her, so that she pushed him and he pushed her back. All just an excuse to touch each other, really. And she had known that they probably would kiss, and felt okay about it, because she had liked him for ages. And although he was a laugh, he wasn't too pushy, and he wasn't the type to go blagging to his mates afterwards. Plus, he didn't think she was weird, because her house was full of books, and her mum wore second-hand clothes. He had even told some of the girls to back off when they called her brainache and spod for taking her exams early and not smoking. But then he had got carried away, and instead of pushing her back, he had picked her up in a fireman's lift, as if he was going to take her somewhere, and she had panicked and shouted at him to put her down, and when he had laughed, she had hit him repeatedly, too hard, across the head. He had dropped her after that, stood back and looked at her, holding his reddened ear, and asking her what was the matter with her. But she couldn't explain, so she just laughed, even though she felt like crying, and tried to make a joke of it. But he hadn't laughed, and things had never been quite the same between them. And then a week later, she had heard he was hanging around with Amanda Gallagher. Amanda bloody Gallagher, with her long girly girl hair, fabric-conditioned clothes and cheap perfume. Probably Amanda bloody Baxter by the time she got home. Perhaps it was time to forget about Dean Baxter. He had bad skin on his back anyway, his sister had told her. Sabine shook her head, clearing it of unwelcome thoughts, and thought about Tom instead. She always found it was easier if you thought about someone else. He was the only man around who was remotely good-looking, she had decided. Pretty handsome, in fact. She'd never been out with an older man, although her mate Ally had, and she had said they really know their way around. But she couldn't quite get past the idea of his arm. She worried that if she ever got round to kissing him, or would they just pant, him being Irish, and took off their clothes, she might run away in fright when she saw his stump. She thought too much of him to upset him like that. She didn't know whether he fancied her. He always seemed pretty pleased to see her, and to like her hanging around. Plus, she could tell him anything. But it was hard to imagine him overcome with passion, or staring at her with intense longing. He was too withdrawn somehow, too restrained. Maybe he just needed time. Maybe grown-up romance worked differently. Thinking about grown-up romance made Sabine think of her mother,
and she slid off the bed, keen to distract herself. With Bella padding around after her, she opened her cupboards, breathing in the musty smell of things long undisturbed, and gazing into their dark depths. Her grandparents didn't even have the right sort of junk. Other people's bedroom cupboards were filled with cocktail dresses and old board games or boxes of letters or electronic gadgets that no longer worked. Here they had piles of mouldering embroidered white linen, tablecloths and the like, a broken lampshade and some books with titles like A Girl's Guide to Horsemanship and Bunty Annual 1967. Emboldened by the complicit, silent house, Sabine set off to explore some of the other rooms. Her grandfather's door was closed, but between his and the bathroom was another room, which she had not yet been into. Pulling the handle down slowly so that she didn't make a noise, she opened the door and slid in. It was a man's room, a study of sorts, but without the air of recent activity that characterized the yard office downstairs, which had tables full of letters and ledgers and colour catalogues full of stud horses, with names like Filigree Jumping Jake the Third by Filigree Flancake out of Jumping Jemima, all of whom looked pretty much the same to her, although Tom had said you could count their differences in tens of thousands of guineas. This study held the dusty air of neglect, its half-opened curtains hanging perfectly still, as if sculpted. It smelt of mildewed paper and unbeaten carpets, and tiny particles of dust glinted, suspended in the air as she moved. Sabine closed the door softly behind her and walked into the centre of the room. Bella looked up hopefully, then dropped, groaning, onto the rug. There were no pictures of horses on the walls in here, apart from a framed cartoon of a shouting huntsman, just a yellowed, framed map of the Far East, and a few black-and-white photographs of people in 1950s gear to cover the vast expanse of William Morris-style wallpaper. On built-in shelves by the window sat various-sized boxes, some of which had rolled-up manuscripts on the top, while on the centre of the desk stood a large model of a grey battleship, presumably to scale. On a dark wood bookshelf to her right stood lots of hardback books, mainly about war and Southeast Asia, punctuated by a couple of humorous cartoon compilations and a paperback on after-dinner speaking. On the top shelf was a series of decrepit leather-bound books, the gilt almost entirely rubbed off their spines. It was the other side of the room that caught her eye. Two leather-bound photograph albums resting on a large box. Judging by their generous icing of dust, they had not been moved for some years. Sabine crouched down and gently pulled out one of the albums. It was labelled 1955. Sitting cross-legged, she pulled it into her lap and opened it, fingering the fine tissue between each of its stiff leaves. The pictures sat one to a page, and the first was of her grandmother. At least she thought it was her grandmother. It was a posed studio shot of a young woman on a window seat, wearing a dark, slightly severe jacket with a tiny collar, a matching dress and a string of pearls. Her hair, which was dark brown instead of grey, had been set in waves, and she was wearing the makeup of the age, heavy brows and lashes, and dark, carefully outlined lips. She looked, for all her posing, slightly embarrassed, as if she had been caught doing something suspect. The next photograph was of her with a tall young man. They stood next to a stand with a plant on it, he beaming with pride, her arm posted uncertainly through his, barely acknowledging him. She looked less awkward this time, more sure of herself, curiously dignified. It was something about her bearing or her tall, slender frame. She didn't slouch over her breasts, looking faintly apologetic, in the way that Sabine's mother did. Sabine, now engrossed, flicked through the entire album. Towards the end of it, as well as pictures of her grandmother, looking at her most relaxed in a snapshot with another young, incredibly glamorous woman, were pictures of a baby in the kind of elaborate christening robe that you never saw now, all intricate crochet and tiny silk-covered buttons. There was no label, so Sabine found herself staring hard at the picture, trying to work out whether this smiling, swaddled baby could possibly be her mother or her Uncle Christopher. You couldn't even tell whether it was a boy or a girl. At that age, they seemed to dress babies the same. But it was in the box that things really started to get interesting. A cardboard-back picture of her grandmother. It was definitely her, she had decided. Arm in arm with the glamorous, shorter girl, both holding little Union Jack pennants and laughing unrestrainedly. It was odd to think her grandmother had laughed like that once. Behind them was a party or gathering, with most of the men handsome in white, like Richard Gere in An Officer and a Gentleman. There was a tray of tall glasses beside them, which made Sabine wonder if she was drunk, and gilt lettering at the bottom announced that the event had been in honour of Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth II's coronation in 1953. That was history. Sabine had to sit still and digest that for a moment. Her grandmother had been around to make history. And then there was the other, smaller photograph. Among the pictures of horses and unrecognisable smiling faces on long, thin boats was a picture of a little girl around 6 years old who was definitely her mother. She had Kate's reddish, curly hair, and even at that age, her peculiar lock-kneed way of standing. She was holding hands with a little boy who might or might not have been Chinese, and smiling broadly from under a straw hat. He seemed a little more awkward, not daring to look straight at the camera, but leaning towards the girl as if for comfort. So this was how my mother grew up, Sabine thought, fingering the sepia-tinted print. Surrounded by little Chinese boys and girls. She had always known that Kate had spent the first part of her childhood abroad, but until now, looking at her pale cotton dress and hat, she hadn't conceived of her as something exotic. Curious, she began flicking through the other photographs, looking for more pictures of her mother. She was roused abruptly from her reverie by the sound of a door slamming downstairs and a muffled cry that might have been someone calling her name. Panicked, she leapt towards the door, followed by Bella, opening and swiftly closing it behind her. She glanced down at her watch. It was 12:30. She paused for a minute, whispered to the dog not to tell.
"Oh, God," she groaned when she realised who she was talking to. "They've got me at it now."
Then walked slowly down the stairs, brushing the dust from her hands as she went. Mrs. H. was in the kitchen, her apron already on. "Ah, there ye are. I'm running late, Sabine," she said, smiling. "I got held up at Annie's. Has your grandfather mentioned what he wants for his lunch?"
"He hasn't said much, actually."
"Ah, well, I'll do him poached eggs on toast. He had a good breakfast, so he won't want anything too heavy. What'll you want?"
"The same?" "Yeah, that'll be great."
Sabine realised with a lurch that she had not woken her grandfather an hour before his lunch as instructed. She began to walk back upstairs, shooing away Bella, who tried to accompany her again, wondering whether, if he was really running late, she was going to have to help him get dressed.
"Please, God, don't let me have to touch him," she prayed outside his door. "Please don't let him mention anything about bed-baths or chamber pots, or whatever it is old people need to get ready. And please, God, let him have his teeth in so that I don't get hysterical."
Hello? She called through the door. There was no reply. "Hello?" She said it louder this time, remembering his deafness.
Grandfather? Oh, God, he was asleep. She was going to have to touch him to wake him up.
Sabine stood outside the door and took a deep breath. She didn't want to feel that crepey, translucent skin under her fingers. Old people made her feel funny, even when she looked at them at home. They seemed too vulnerable, too prone to breakage and bruising. Looking at them up close made her toes clench. She thought of her grandmother's reaction if she didn't do it. She knocked loudly, waited again, and entered. The bed, which sat squarely at the far end of the room, was beautiful, a Gothic four-poster, from whose frame ancient blood-red tapestries with glints of Chinese gold thread hung between carved posts of glowing darkened wood. On the bed itself sat layer upon layer of old silk counterpane, from under which pure white linen sheets could be glimpsed, like teeth in a glossy red mouth. It was the kind of bed you saw in American films when they were trying to imagine what English stately homes were like. It had the exotic sheen of the Far East, of emperors and opium dens. It was as far removed from her creaky iron-frame bed as she could imagine. But it didn't have him in it. It took Sabine less than 10 seconds to realize that not only was he not in it, but that there was nowhere else in the room he could be, unless he had climbed into the wardrobe, which she very much doubted, but checked just to be sure. He must be in the bathroom. Sabine strode back out of the room and along the corridor. The door was ajar, so she called first, but hearing no reply, pushed it, and found that the bathroom, too, had a definite absence of old person. Sabine's head raced. Her grandmother hadn't told her that he was going to go out. She said he was sleeping. So where the hell was he? She checked her grandmother's empty room. Much more frugal, she noted. The downstairs bathroom, and then, feeling increasingly panicked, every single room in the house, from breakfast room to boot room. He was nowhere to be seen. It was nearly 1:45. She had to tell someone. She ran to the downstairs kitchen and confessed to Mrs. H. that she had somehow mislaid her grandfather. "Is he not in his room?" "No, I looked there first." "Oh, God. Where's Bertie?" Sabine stared at her, and then behind her at Bella. "I haven't seen him," she said. "He's gone out with the dog. He's not meant to go out by himself now, especially not with Bertie, because he's young and knocks his stick from under him." She stepped out from behind the table and went to remove her apron. "We'd better go and look for him before Mrs. Valentine gets back." "No, no, you stay here and watch the house. I'll get Tom to help." Sabine, her chest now tight with fear, ran to the yard, peering over stable doors and shouting his name. Tom, a sandwich held to his mouth, poked his head out of the tack room. Behind him she could hear the radio and just make out the seated figures of Liam and John John reading the Racing Post. "Where's the fire?" It's the old man. I can't find him."
"What do you mean you can't find him?"
"He was meant to be in his room sleeping. Mrs. H. thinks he may have gone out with Bertie, and she says Bertie knocks him over. Will you help me look for him?"
Tom swore under his breath, his eyes already scanning the middle distance. "Don't touch my lunch, you bastards," he muttered, then grabbed his coat and walked briskly into the yard.
"I'm really, really sorry. I just don't know what to do. He was meant to be in the house."
"Okay," he said, thinking hard. "You go and check up and down the road, and if he's not there, check the top fields. I'll do the bottom fields and the orchard, and I'll do the barns too. You're sure you've looked everywhere in the house? I mean, he couldn't just be watching the telly."
Sabine, now frightened by Tom's expression, felt tears prick at the corners of her eyes.
"Everywhere. And Bertie's gone. He must have taken him out."
"Jesus, what did the old idiot have to go out for? Look, take Bella and keep calling Bertie. If he's taken a fall, hopefully the dog might take us to him. I'll meet you back here in 20 minutes. And here's the hunting horn. If you find him, give it a good blow."
He handed it to her, turned, vaulted over the post and rail fencing, and ran towards the fields below them, both of which were surrounded by high hedges. Sabine, with Bella chasing joyfully behind, jogged out of the front gates and up the lane, calling with every second breath. Unsure at which point she should turn round, she ran until her chest hurt, past the big farmhouse on the corner, the little church, and a row of smaller cottages. It was drizzling, and the clouds gathered slate-grey above her, as if heralding some great doom. Her head filled with unwelcome pictures of the old man in a crumpled heap at the side of the road. Sabine ran harder the other way, until, unable to see a clock, she decided she should go back to check the top fields.
"Where are you, you bugger?" she whispered. "Where are you?"
Then she jumped, her heart briefly stalling, as a huge green tarpaulin, half stuck into the hedge, moved towards her. Bella stood stiff-legged, a few paces in front of her, her hackles raised. She barked once in warning. Heart thumping, eyes wide, Sabine stood still in the centre of the road, and then taking deep breaths, peered closer, lifting a corner. If she hadn't been so anxious, she would have laughed. Under the huge plastic sheet stood a grey donkey, harnessed to a small cart. It opened its eyes briefly, as if acknowledging her presence, then turned back resignedly towards the relative shelter of the hedge. Sabine let the tarpaulin drop gently and began to run again, her eyes scanning from left to right. There was nothing, no sign of him. Above the pounding of her heart and heels and the thin hiss of the rain in her ears, she could hear no welcoming bark, no impatient upper-class croak, no hunting horn. Sabine, now properly fearful, began to cry.
He was obviously dead. Everyone would blame her, she thought, stumbling down the grassy hill. He would be found, frozen and damp, probably with his powdery bones broken where Bertie had pulled him over onto the hard concrete. And he would contract pneumonia, and his heart would give out, and it would all be her fault, because she was too busy reading dirty books and being nosy to care. Her grandmother would be even angrier than when she let the Duke out. Tom would never talk to her again. Her mother would refuse to take her back for effectively murdering her father, so she would be stuck here. While the villagers looked on silently and pointed like something out of Deliverance, and she became known as the girl who killed her own grandfather.
Sabine had not thought to wear Wellingtons, and down in the boggy pasture her feet became waterlogged by mud. Viscous and brown, it crept over the tops of her trainers, sucking and releasing with each footfall, impregnating her feet with its chilled damp. A week ago she would have been hysterical about the state of her new Reeboks, but she was now so miserable she hardly noticed. Realizing it was some half an hour since she had set out, she sobbed out loud, wiping her running nose on the back of her hand. It was at this point that Bella, sodden and unhappy, began to head back towards the house.
"Don't you leave me as well,"
Sabine cried, but Bella ignored her, apparently determined to restore herself to shelter and the comfort of a warm arbour. She didn't know where to look next. She would have to ask Tom. She trudged up the hill behind the dog, unsure what she was going to say to Mrs. H., but certain that somehow she would be to blame. By the time she got to the house, Bella had disappeared. Sabine, pushing her wet hair out of her eyes, trying to get her snivelling under control, lifted the latch on the back door and pushed it open, hearing as she did footsteps pounding across the gravel behind her. It was Tom, his hair plastered to his head, and his false arm, with another hunting horn, held awkwardly to his chest. She was about to apologize when she saw he was looking straight past her.
"You're late," came a voice from down the corridor.
Allowing herself a second to acclimatize to the dark, Sabine stared down the flagstone passageway to where she could just make out the curved back, the third leg of a walking stick, and two chocolate-coloured dogs grunting happily around each other in greeting.
"Lunch was at one. One. It's getting cold. I really don't see that I should have to tell you again."
Sabine stood, her mouth agape, in the doorway, subsumed by conflicting emotions. "He got back about 5 minutes ago," muttered Tom behind her. "We must have crossed paths with him."
"Well, come on, come on. You can't possibly sit down looking like that," scolded her grandfather. "You'll have to change your shoes."
"The old bastard,"
whispered Sabine tearfully, and felt Tom's good hand on her shoulder in reply. Mrs. H., leaning from the kitchen door, mouthed an apology and shrugged helplessly.
"Will I get you a dry jumper, Mr. Valentine?" she asked.
but was waved irritably away. She ducked back inside the kitchen. Her grandfather turned stiffly towards the stairs, shaking droplets of water from his hat with his free hand. The dogs pushed past him, so that, briefly unbalanced, he thrust out a spindly arm to catch hold of the banister.
"I shan't tell you again,"
he muttered something to himself and shook his head. It was barely visible above the exaggerated curve of his shoulders.
"Mrs. H., if you'd be kind enough to bring me my lunch. It seems my granddaughter would rather eat in a corridor."
It had been shortly after tea that Sabine had counted up the money her mother had given her to see if she had enough to get her back to England. Her mother wouldn't like it, but she couldn't see how living with her and the odious Justin could be any worse than staying here. This was impossible. Even when she tried to do the right thing, they acted like she'd deliberately done wrong. They didn't care about her. All they cared about were bloody horses and their stupid, rigid rules. She could be lying in the kitchen with an axe in her head, and they'd tell her off for bringing tools into the house. She was scanning her ferry ticket for a booking line number when there was a soft knock at the door. It was Mrs. H. "Why don't you come over to our Annie's with me this evening? Your grandmother says it would be fine, and it'll be nice for you to have some younger people around you." What she meant was, it's probably best if you and your grandparents give each other a bit of a break. But Sabine didn't mind. Anything was better than spending another evening with them. Annie was Mrs. H.'s only daughter. She lived in the large farmhouse further up the village, which she ran as a bed and breakfast with her husband Patrick, a much older man who wrote books. "I've never read one. Not my cup of tea," said Mrs. H., "but I'm told they're very good. For intellectual types, you know." Annie's skills as hostess were less assured. The B&B was legendary, according to Tom, for never retaining guests for a second night. She forgot stuff, apparently, like breakfast, or even that she had guests at all, and some objected to her habit of walking around the house in the early hours of the morning. But neither Tom nor Mrs. H. elaborated on that. "She's not that much older than you. 27. How old are you again?" "Oh, well, she's a bit older than you, but you like her. Everyone does. Just don't mind if she's a bit, well, a bit distracted." Sabine, walking slowly down the dark, wet road with Mrs. H., both huddled under a rather tired umbrella, was intrigued. Picturing some Maud Gonne type, all wild red hair and floaty skirts, waving away domestic queries with a thin artistic wrist. Annie's eccentric habits sounded a million miles from those of Kilcarrion House. A woman who forgot to make breakfast wasn't likely to want to hold a formal supper, was she? And a writer husband didn't sound as if all he would want to do was talk about horses. She might be able to relax this evening, sparkle and be witty in admiring company. Perhaps watch proper telly. Annie might even have satellite. Lots of Irish houses seem to. And besides, Mrs. H. told her that Tom would pop by later. He often did, apparently, just to see how Annie was doing. But the Annie who opened the door was not quite the glamorous eccentric Sabine had envisaged. She was a short woman in an oversized jumper, with straight shoulder-length brown hair, full lips and big sad eyes. They wrinkled into a greeting as she held out her hand, not to shake Sabine's, but to pull her gently into the house. She was also, Sabine noted a little sadly, wearing chain store jeans. "Sabine, how are you? Lovely of you to stop by. Hi, ma'am. Did you bring the bacon?" "I did. I put it in the fridge." There was no hallway. They walked straight into the living room, almost one side of which was taken up by an old stone fireplace, complete with fiercely burning log fire. Two long, slightly tatty blue sofas sat at right angles to it, while a coffee table stood between them, burdened with huge, precarious piles of magazines and books. Now that she looked properly, books were everywhere. They lined each wall on sagging shelves and lay under stools and tables in irregular heaps. "Those are Patrick's," Annie said from the kitchen area at the other end of the room. "He's a great one for reading." "Annie, What have you prepared for the supper? Mrs. H. stood up from the fridge and stared around her, as if expecting to see some pan bubbling on the stove. Annie rubbed at her forehead, frowning. Ah, ma'am, I'm sorry. It went clean out of me mind. We can stick something in the microwave.
We cannot, said Mrs. H., affronted. I'm not having Sabine going back to the big house, saying we never fed her properly.
I wouldn't say that, said Sabine, who really didn't mind. I'm not that hungry anyway.
A skinny girl like you.
In fact, look at the both of yous. I've seen more meat on a butcher's dog. Annie, you sit down and talk to Sabine, and I'll do us some chops. I put some in the freezer a couple of weeks ago.
I'm not a great meat eater, Sabine ventured.
No, no, of course you're not. Well, then you can eat the vegetables, and we'll do you a cheese sandwich on the side. How's that?
Annie grinned at Sabine conspiratorially and motioned at her to sit down. She didn't talk much, but in that way that prompted confidences. And before long, Sabine found herself unburdening herself of the many unhappinesses and injustices to which she was subjected at Kilcarrion House. She told Annie about the endless rules and regulations, and how completely impossible it was to remember them all. She told her how ridiculously difficult it was to communicate with her grandparents, and how hopelessly old-fashioned they were. She told her about how alien she felt among all these horse obsessives, and how she missed her mates and her telly, and her own home and all her things, like her CDs and her computer. Annie just listened and nodded understandingly, so that after a while Sabine suspected she had heard much of this already from Mrs. H. That just fueled her sense of victimhood. But that was what she must be, she mused, if they were talking about her in sympathetic tones.
And why is your ma'am not over here, Sabine? Is she working?
Sabine halted briefly, unsure how much to give away. They were nice people, but she hardly knew them, and she felt some loyalty to her mother.
Yes, she lied. She wanted to come over, but she was too busy.
What does she do now? Said Mrs. H. It's so long since I've seen her.
She writes, she paused. Not books and stuff, just features for newspapers. About families.
Any old families?
Mrs. H. thrust a tray of food into the oven.
Not really. Family life in general. Problems and stuff.
That sounds very handy, said Mrs. H.
You must miss her, said Annie.
Sorry? Your ma'am. You must miss her.
Her being so far away and all.
A bit.
She hesitated, then said boldly,
We're not that close, actually.
But she's your ma'am.
You must be close.
And suddenly, inexplicably, Annie's eyes filled with tears. Sabine stared at her in horror, trying to work out what she could have said to have prompted this. Mrs. H., looking sharply at her daughter, called,
Sabine, I found a bit of fish in the freezer cabinet. Do you fancy this, if I do it in a butter sauce? Perhaps you could help me defrost it in the microwave. Annie, love, why don't you go and fetch Patrick and tell him we'll be eaten in about 20 minutes?
Sabine stood up slowly, and trying not to stare too conspicuously at Annie, walked over to the kitchen. Annie was very quiet for about half an hour after that. She hardly spoke through supper, and her husband said little, so it was left to Mrs. H. and Sabine, who was feeling rather unnerved, to carry the conversation. Patrick was not the writer type she had imagined, not thin and tortured-looking, but a big man, barrel-chested, and slightly coarse-featured, with lines like ploughed furrows along his forehead and down the sides of his mouth. But he was gentle and solicitous, and he had that quiet air of intelligence which made Sabine slightly tongue-tied, and aware that almost everything she said sounded trite or stupid.
"Is your dinner all right, Patrick? It was all a bit of a rush job, I'm afraid."
"It's grand, ma'am," he replied. "Lovely bit of lamb."
Sabine, who found herself staring at Annie, found it hard to picture the two together. He was so big and rough-looking, while she was so washed out and insubstantial, as if some melancholy breeze could just blow her away. And yet he obviously adored her, although he said little.
Sabine noticed him touch her arm twice and once rub her back with slow, loving strokes.
"Have you anyone common this weekend?"
said Mrs. H., picking up one of her chops with her knife and fork and placing it on Patrick's already overstuffed plate. Patrick looked at Annie, then back at his mother-in-law.
"I don't think there's anyone booked. I had a thought Annie and I might go up to Galway just for a bit of a change."
"Galway!"
exclaimed Mrs. H.
"Loch Innagh?
Now there's a beautiful spot. Me and your father used to holiday there every year when you were small, Annie. The weather was always terrible for some reason, but you used to love it. We bought you these Wellington boots with glitter on, you see, and you just ran up and down in the water all day long." Annie didn't look up. Briefly lost in past happinesses, Mrs. H. continued, "One night, you even insisted on sleeping in them. You loved those boots so much. In the morning, your bed was that full of sand, I had to shake your sheets out of the window. Ah, bless, you were only 3. Annie shot a sharp look at her mother, who abruptly shut up. For a few minutes, all that could be heard was the spit and crackle of the fire and the distant thrum of the rain on the windowsill. Sabine, watching, glanced back at Annie, wondering what Mrs. H. had said that was so wrong. But she just looked down again and pushed her half-full plate towards the centre of the table. Curiously, Mrs. H. didn't seem to mind. She just waited until she was sure everyone had finished and began collecting the plates. Not in that kind of brisk, "I'm doing this to make a point" way that Kate did when Sabine had been rude to her. She just seemed genuinely unoffended, as if all she had to consider was the destination of the plates.
"It doesn't have to be Galway," said Patrick gently in his wife's ear. "We could go to Dublin, a city break. It's meant to be a great crack at the moment."
There was a brief pause. "Maybe another time, eh?" Annie patted her husband's arm, stood, and walked without explanation from the room. Mrs. H. pushed back her own chair and went towards the kitchen.
"Now, Sabine, you'll have some pudding, won't you? We've got some apple pie that I can heat up in the microwave, or a bit of chocolate ice cream. I bet you'll not say no to some ice cream, am I right?"
She didn't give Sabine time to wonder what was going on. Patrick, with an affectionate kiss on his mother-in-law's cheek, also left the room, but nodded to a query about pudding, which suggested he would soon be back. It was at this perplexing moment that the door opened and Tom walked in, the wind blowing behind him and his oilcloth coat slick with rain. Sabine almost ran to greet him. She'd started to feel a little uncomfortable.
"Have I missed dinner? One of the boxes started letting in water, so I thought I should try and whack a tarpaulin on the roof before I left."
"It's filthy out there," he said. "Sit down, love, sit down. Put your coat over by that chair. I've kept yours in the oven. Lamb chops all right for you."
The atmosphere in the room immediately relaxed and expanded, so that Sabine sat back in her chair. Tom always seemed to diffuse tension. She grinned at him and he grinned back.
"Did you get to watch some good telly then, Sabine?"
Sabine looked at Mrs. H.
"I didn't come just to watch the telly. I wanted to meet everybody." "Ah, was there something you wanted to watch, love?"
"To be honest, what with the dinner and everything, I didn't give it a thought."
"Well, let's have it on while we're having our pudding, shall we? There might be a film on, mightn't there?"
They sat, channel surfing companionably as Tom wolfed his way through his food. He ate voraciously, head down, his knife and fork working in tandem to scoop the food into his mouth. The kind of eating employed by siblings of large families, determined not to lose out on second helpings. Mrs. H. nodded and smiled with silent satisfaction. She was evidently fond of her nephew. She looked at him as one would a favoured son. Sabine, watching this in the warm room, her own stomach full and the distant roar of the wind and rain outside, felt a pang that her grandmother's house couldn't feel enclosed and warm like this one. She didn't even know these people, and already she felt loath to return to Kilcarrion House. She looked up as Annie walked back in, smiling. Patrick was standing behind her, looking a little anxious.
"Hi there, Tomcat," Annie said, ruffling Tom's hair.
How's my favourite cousin? You look like a drowned rat. You want to try going out sometime? Said Tom, reaching up and squeezing her hand. It's called weather. Still smiling, Annie sat back down at the table. Patrick sat next to her, gazing at his wife. He didn't touch his pudding.
Where have you been all week?
Annie said to Tom. I've hardly seen hide nor hair of you. I've been around, he said. Busy time of year. Getting the horses ready for the start of the season. All right there, Patrick. You and your horses. You want to get yourself a girlfriend? Have some proper interests?
What happened to that girl from the restaurant? She was all right.
Tom didn't look up from his food. Not my type.
And what is your type?
Not her. Mrs. H, wiping down surfaces in the kitchen, burst into a laugh.
You should know by now, Annie. You'll not get Tom to tell you a thing. He could have a wife and 6 children at home, and his own family would know nothing about it. Have you ever met a bloke like him, eh, Sabine?
Sabine found she was blushing. To her relief, no one noticed.
Your trouble is you're too picky, said Annie, pushing her melted ice cream around a bowl.
Probably.
Mrs. H glanced at her daughter a few times, but didn't remark upon her brief absence. She busied herself with the washing up, dismissing Sabine's half-hearted offer to help.
You sit down. You're the guest.
Oh, don't say that, ma'am. You'll make her feel like one of the Toobies.
Sabine glanced at Tom for explanation.
Toobies, B&Bs, said Patrick, are paying guests.
I thought they were inmates, said Tom.
You're not saying you make them pay as well.
You're not a guest, said Annie, ignoring him and placing a hand on Sabine's arm. You're a Ballantine, so you're practically family. And you're welcome any time. I could do with the company.
Her smile was genuinely warm.
Mrs. H nodded as if confirming it. Would you like a cup of tea, Patrick? I could bring it up to you if you're working.
Thanks, ma'am. I'm fine with my wine here.
Tom, have you got a drink?
Sabine went to pass him the bottle of wine, but almost before she could get there, Mrs. H had passed him a glass of orange juice, which he picked up and drained greedily.
I'll have another drink, said Annie, looking around her. Where's my glass gone?
I washed it up, said Mrs. H.
Well, you can pass me another one then. I hadn't finished that.
How's the book going? Tom asked. Patrick shook his head. It's a bit sticky at the moment, to tell you the truth.
I don't know how you do it, sitting up there by yourself day after day, said Mrs. H. I'd be bored out of me mind. No people, no one to talk to, just those characters in your head. I'm surprised you don't go mad.
Right then, I'm done. I'll be off in a minute. Your father's out at his club this evening, and I want to be in before he gets home.
Off to meet your fancy man, eh, ma'am?
Patrick stood up and held out her coat for her.
Don't worry, we won't say a thing.
She likes to welcome him home, said Tom, shaking his head in disbelief.
If I like to welcome me husband home, then it's no one else's business but our own, she said, pinking slightly.
And the neighbours, said Patrick, grinning at Tom. The poor things.
You're a rogue, Patrick Connolly, Mrs. H said, now bright pink.
Will someone walk Sabine home all right? I don't want her on that dark road by herself.
It's only 100 yards, I'm fine honest, said Sabine, chafing at the suggestion of her youth.
Don't worry, said Tom. We'll chuck her out after closing time.
Thanks for cooking, ma'am, said Annie, walking her to the door and kissing her. She was smiling all the time now, a soft, gentle smile, although it still didn't stretch to her eyes.
Right behind her, Patrick kissed his wife tenderly, then walked slowly back upstairs. She patted him vaguely in response, as one would a child.
As Sabine watched, Annie closed the door after her mother, then stood still in the centre of the room, as if unsure where to put herself. After a few seconds, she walked over to the sofa and collapsed on it, tucking her knees under her chin.
"Right, Sabine, why don't you find a film or something?" she said, looking suddenly desperately weary.
"And you too, chat. I hope you don't mind, but I'll probably just crash here. I'm all out of talking today."
Your friend Melissa rang and wanted to know if you were going to go to her party on the 15th.
I told her I didn't know if you were going to be back or not.
Oh.
And Goebbels was sick in your room, but I've put your rug in the dry cleaners, and they think it will be no problem. Is he all right?
He's fine. It's just because I ran out of cat food and he wolfed down a can of tuna.
You're not meant to give him tuna.
I know, sweetheart, but the corner shop was shut, and I couldn't see him go hungry. He's all right with it when he doesn't eat so quickly.
Sabine had rung her mother the previous day with the intention of begging her for enough money to get her home. She was going to tell her that she loved her and that she was sorry for being such a cow and that everything would be better if she could just come home, because she knew, and she knew her mother would understand, that she couldn't stand being stuck here one more minute. But they had been on the phone some 7 minutes now, her mother evidently a bit bemused as to what Sabine had wanted when she left her urgent message to call. Yet Sabine just couldn't find the words. She wanted to go back, she really did. But it was somehow less urgent since the previous evening at Annie's house. And she found that she was still deep inside somewhere, furious about Jeff and Justin. And it was so hard being overly nice to her mother. Kate got all emotional and said too much back, so that Sabine ended up regretting saying anything and feeling faintly cross, as if she had somehow given too much away. Her mother could never just let things be.
So, what have you been up to?
Has Granny got you riding yet?
No, and I'm not going to.
What have you been doing with yourself?
Sabine thought about the box of photographs which she had revisited that morning while her grandmother was out of the shop, and the one she had found of her mother as a young girl with a Chinese boy. She thought of Annie's house and the way Annie had just gone to sleep in front of her last night, as abruptly as anything, as if she didn't care what anybody even thought of her doing so. She thought of Tom asking, with just a shade too much awkwardness, what it was her mother did these days.
Nothing, she said.
Chapter 3 Goebbels the cat sat on the top of the gatepost like a stone sentry, his slightly raised fur a textured gauge of the freezing temperatures outside. Across the road, in a woolly hat, Mr. Agonier worked on his car, as he so often did, thrusting himself determinedly under the bonnet like a circus tamer entering a lion's mouth, then withdrawing from it, wiping his hands mournfully on a piece of cloth, as if plucking up the courage to do it again. Between the dustbins, most of which were still standing by the curb, abandoned since the morning collection, two crisp packets chased each other in gritty circles.
Have you ever wondered whether you and your child are speaking the same language?
Well, according to new research from Switzerland, you may not be. In a report likely to raise murmurs of "I knew it" in households across Europe, social psychologists from the University of Geneva have discovered that what parents say and what children hear are often two different things. Agnes, wearing a thin blue coat and walking slowly with her new aluminium frame, stopped and spoke to him as she passed, and Mr. Agonie shrugged sadly, gesturing towards his engine. As they spoke, the cold air solidified into little mushroom clouds in front of them, like speech bubbles waiting to be filled.
Parents very rarely put themselves into their children's shoes, said Professor Friedrich Ansburger, who headed the study of 2,000 families. Yet if they did, they would understand why often their children completely disregard their instructions. It's not necessarily disobedience. It's just that it doesn't fit their alternative brand of logic.
Kate sighed and made herself look back at her computer.
It had taken her almost an hour to write 3 paragraphs, and at this rate she was going to be earning an hourly rate that would shock a Bangladeshi sweatshop. It was not hard for a woman with her imagination to come up with reasons for her inability to work these last days. For a start, the house was too silent. Even though Sabine was rarely in, Kate found that their home was curiously deadened by the knowledge that the front door was not about to slam, that she was not going to hear the familiar footfall clumping up the stairs, the closing of the bedroom door, followed by the muffled beat of some inaudible band, and, just occasionally, a muttered hello. Then there was the central heating, whose failure had left her swaddled in layers like a bag lady, and at which the plumber had shaken his head with a look of pitied resignation not dissimilar to Mr. Rigoni's own, promising to come back with the right part. That had been 3 days ago. Then there was this stupid piece which stubbornly refused to write itself. On a good day, Kate could churn out 2 800-word features before lunch. Today was not one of those days. Contacts failed to return calls. Words slid awkwardly around a page. Kate's motivation levels sank underneath her own self-pity. For this was the first week that in her adult life she had been properly on her own. Sabine had always been there. And when she was off on school trips or away with friends, there had been Jeff, and before him, Jim. She had always known there was going to be someone at the end of the day with whom to share a bowl of pasta, a bottle of wine, and mull over the day's events. Now Jeff was gone, Justin was away on a working trip with no discernible deadline, and Sabine was in Ireland, apparently determined to speak to her as little as possible. And it was all her own fault. For the umpteenth time she tried not to think about how Jeff would have got the central heating sorted out within hours. He had been the practical one. He had numbers that summoned reliable workmen whom he had known for years, and who would generally come to them first as a favour, to be rewarded by a generous drink, as Jeff always quaintly called it. When he had first urged Kate to give their electrician a drink, she had made him a cup of herbal tea, and the two men had grinned ruefully at each other, then laughed in a back-slapping, we're all blokes together kind of way. At the time, she had hated it, seeing it as evidence of some kind of perceived naivety on her part. In a freezing house, with the benefit of hindsight, she found it quite endearing. But she couldn't ask Jeff. And Justin, as he had told her regretfully, didn't do domestic. In fact, 3 months into this relationship, there were increasing numbers of things Justin didn't do. He didn't do phoning every night while he was away. Look, sweetheart, it's just not always possible. My mobile's always running out, and if we work late or in really dodgy areas, the last thing I can do is go out hunting for a phone box. He didn't do living together. I love what we've got. I don't want to spoil it, and I would spoil it. And he didn't do planning into the future. You are the most fabulous woman I've ever met. I want to be with you more than I've ever wanted to be with anyone. And that's just going to have to do for now. Kate stared unseeing at her computer screen, made herself focus on the things he did do, scolding herself for looking for problems. He loved her, didn't he? He told her so all the time. Agnes was still gamely shoving her frame before her towards the corner of the street, her white fluffy head bobbing on its frail neck like a dandelion in the breeze. She would be on her way to Lewis's Cafe on the High Street, where every day, with relentless regularity, she arrived at 12:45 for her egg, chips, tea, and a solitary chuckle at the tabloids. After that she would travel,
depending on the day, to either the bingo hall, the drop-in centre, or the library, returning home only when the institution closed. It had taken Kate several years of living next door to Agnes to discover that her neighbour's admirably sociable lifestyle disguised her inability to heat her maisonette properly. "Come on," she told herself, chilled by her sudden sense of empathy. "Finish this piece, or you have to go out." Perhaps all this solitude would be for the best. Jeff was coming for the last of his stuff this evening, and after the disaster of their first meeting, she couldn't cope with having him and Justin together. It was hard enough seeing Jeff by himself. Kate sat there, staring at the words in front of her, debating her two mutually unattractive options for the afternoon ahead. Then she swapped her glasses for contact lenses, added an extra layer of clothing, and with a deep sense of foreboding, headed off to the community centre.